brace yourself, because you're about to dive into another free first-hour episode of the Higher Side Chats, and we just want to let you know that whether you're looking for a companion through your paranoid insomnia, entertaining yourself through one of life's mundane activities, or trying to ward off the internal screams of all those sad, smothered souls around the office, THC is here. And you should know that every episode of the Higher Side Chats has an entire second hour for Plus members. Sign up at thehiresidechatsplus.com, and you'll get years of Plus show archives, lifetime forum access, a special invite to Greg Carlwood's monthly joint sessions, MP3s of THC music, bonus episodes, tour videos, and 10% off t-shirts, grinders, and whatever else ends up in the Higher Side store. It's $8 a month that you won't miss, so become a Plus member and treat yourself in these troubled times. Always action-packed and commercial-free, which means you'll unfortunately never hear my voice again.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. Well, we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Christ on a cracker, Higher Side Chatters. How are we doing out there? From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and despite a world of false flags, secret space programs, fractional reserve banking, mind control programs, and more, we cannot overlook the simple things in life. That's where our power as individuals shines, and there's still no shortage of misinformation, deception, and dare I say attacks to overcome when it comes to our health and wellness. We know the AMA was set up as a Rockefeller medicine monopoly from the start, and we've seen the medical schooling sector take the money and drink the Kool-Aid longer than we've been alive. We've seen scandal after scandal with the world's biggest medical companies, yet the media still encourages us to applaud their efforts and donate to the cause. We know that petrochemical pill pushers and sales reps have compromised our doctors' integrity by getting them to promote any new drug they can if it means box seats to next weekend's big game. We've watched the corporate food industry deceive us over fat, sugar, and diet in general. And even when folks do try to play ball, we've seen no shortage of families reach financial ruin thanks to insurance companies and unnecessary exploding costs. Well, it's time to come down from the soapbox and lead by example, by taking the reins of our own lives, putting our alternative information to the test, and making it painfully obvious to the rest of the world that our perspective yields the healthiest and most fulfilling life. But to do that, we need brave souls and bright minds that we can trust, like today's guest, Dr. Stephen Hussey, who knows the repercussions of the system's suggested ways of life firsthand, as his childhood was plagued by health issues, including a type 1 diabetes diagnosis when he was only 9 years old. Stephen went on to develop a passion for health in college, and he attained his doctorate in chiropractic medicine and master's in human nutrition and functional medicine from the University of Western States. Over the years, he has learned the intricacies and details about the power of food to heal the body, and it all began when he used the proper human diet as part of the healing process to rid himself of many chronic health ailments. Today, he practices chiropractic and functional medicine in Roanoke, Virginia, and also coaches people back to health on his website, Resource Your Health. He's also the author of two great books entitled The Heart, Our Most Medically Misunderstood Organ, and more recently, The Health Evolution. So let's do the damn thing. The do-gooding doctor, health evolution educator, and true champion of the people, Dr. Hussey, my man, welcome to the Higher Side.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You got it. You got it. I'm really looking forward to this. You sent me both of your books, and I found a lot of great stuff that I think people are going to appreciate. But I do think some context for your life and your story would be a great way to start, just because I've had a lot of alternative, or maybe we should just say natural, health advocates on THC. And it's usually because of a personal need that they actually undertake the huge task of getting diet right, learning about suppressed or little-known elements of health and wellness. And that seems like it was true for you, too. It was kind of a situation of either change your way of life or completely lose your quality of life.
For sure, yeah. So at a very young age, I was diagnosed with multiple inflammatory chronic conditions, things like asthma. I used to have terrible allergies, had IBS. I used to like break out in huge hives all over my body just because of an inflammatory reaction. And then ultimately ended up with type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune condition. And so I was kind of thrown headfirst into the Western medical world because that's all me and my parents knew what to do at the time. And I guess that as I grew up, especially in college, when I found an interest in health and found that my lifestyle made these things easier to manage, but especially when I went off to get a medical degree and get, you know, functional medicine training, I really started to look at what Western medicine was missing and why it wasn't giving me solutions. It was just kind of suppressing the symptoms that I had associated with these conditions. And so, you know, digging further and further and further, because even my medical education, like as a chiropractor and in functional medicine, it was focused on diagnosis. We do all these tests, blood tests, or assess symptoms and find a diagnosis. And then that gets us to how we can treat. Now, functional medicine was a bit different because we're looking for the why, but I am ever curious, I guess. And I just wanted to know the why of the why. We want to know why these people are sick, but why are they getting sick in the first place? And so I eventually led me to evolution, which is where I wrote this book. But when I really started honing in on evolution and applying that to humans and our health epidemic, I really found the answers I was looking for, that I had been looking for my entire life. And they were ultimately things that led me to the lifestyle changes I made that got rid of all those conditions, aside from the type 1 diabetes, which is kind of collateral damage. So, yeah.
And it is nice to have a robust medical education and some credentials. That is important if you're going to coach people and work with people. But you really had to do a lot of this work independent of the system, right? Because as I understand it, some people can go through the whole medical program and get very little education on diet and nutrition. They just kind of focus on disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess talk to us a little bit about that. Most of what you preach and advocate for is stuff you learned on your own, right?
Yeah, for sure. If we just step back and look at how the whole medical system is set up, I mean, it's a for-profit system. And if you look at the three aspects of it that profit, it's the practitioners, insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical companies. So the pharmaceutical companies are funding the education of the practitioners, most of the practitioners, as far as medical doctors. And so they're going to fund an education that steers those practitioners toward using their products, their pharmaceuticals. And then the practitioners are looking for that diagnosis because they can't get paid by insurance companies unless they have a diagnosis. So someone could be, you know, sick, but if they don't have enough criteria to meet a diagnosis, then the doctor can't help them without getting paid. So that doesn't influence them to help them very much. And then the insurance companies are only going to pay for treatments that have been approved or substantiated by research. And since the pharmaceutical companies are also funding the research, the only research that really gets put out there is that the pharmaceuticals are the best option. So we have this, you know, system where all this money is flowing around between those three pillars, and then the patients aren't getting better because the focus is not on them. It's about where the money is flowing. And so with all that stuff distracting us from finding out what's truly causing disease, we have a system that's not really interested in what's truly causing the disease. So I had to figure out that kind of stuff on my own. And so I go outside the box, find any resource, don't rule anything out, just go and see if it makes sense or see if I can apply it to my life. And that's kind of what I've done. Even though I have this formal chiropractic education and this functional medicine education, I had to look further.
Fair enough. And luckily, we have the golden age of information at our fingertips for people willing to walk the road.
Mm-hmm.
And to elaborate on your story and to quote your book, The Health Evolution, you write, "On a more personal note, I was not a natural birth. I was only partly breastfed and I was fully vaccinated. Those things, along with the poor diet I was eating and the anxious child that I was, led me to the inflammatory childhood I experienced." And that's pretty raw, man. Sometimes this stuff isn't easy for people to admit about themselves and their own upbringing. But it's also empowering when you learn that with better choices, you can have a better life rather than being a victim of circumstance and genetics and just saying, well, I'm sick. That's my life. I mean, it's really empowering to learn about, say, epigenetics, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so there's this huge field of epigenetics right now. And basically, epigenetics is the idea we've kind of proven now that your genes are not set in stone. You have the certain genes that you have, but you can influence the expression of those genes based on the environment you put them in. And that could be anything from the thoughts you're having to the toxins you're exposed to the food that you're eating. anything that you come in contact with in your personal environment. And so when we think about it in that aspect, I think that functional medicine has done a really good job of sharing this knowledge about epigenetics. But what that means to me is that our genetics are in the wrong environment. And so when I started trying to figure out what the ideal environment is for a human, it led me to evolution. And so I guess one of the basic theories of evolution is that when an environment of a species changes too quickly and that species doesn't have the necessary generations it needs to adapt to that change, then its health will struggle. And sometimes it will even die, or the species will go extinct because it changed too fast. And so when you look at epigenetics from that point of view and you apply it to evolution, humans are definitely in the wrong environment.
Yes. And I really think one of the overarching messages drilled into our heads by the big machine is, this is how it is. Improvement is futile. You know, and that kind of crushes our hope for a better world. And this applies to all areas of life, but epigenetics is really dismantling that when it comes to our health and wellness. And I think that is super important. And so let me ask, what are some of the details about those major changes you've made on a personal level that you think have improved your quality of life most? Where did you see the biggest bang for the buck?
Well, I think initially it was diet. I started to realize that what I ate made it so much easier for me to control blood sugars, which is something I have to deal with every day. And I deal with it less and less now because I eat a diet that I really don't have to worry about it that much. And so diet was the first one. And I think that the biggest thing for me is that humans are way more efficient when we burn fat. We've been told that carbohydrates are necessary and they're the bulk of the American diet. If we look at the big food companies out there, they're the ones that produce all the wheat and the corn and the sugar and the soy and things like that. And so these higher carbohydrate foods are driving our metabolism, which is making us burn carbohydrate, which is causing all kinds of damage. I like to say that when we burn carbohydrate, we make more exhaust, just like when a car burns fuel, it makes exhaust. And so that exhaust can actually damage our bodies and make it less efficient. Whereas when we're burning fat, we make way less exhaust and we get more energy from it. And our metabolism just works way better. So that was the first thing for me, going to a higher fat diet, which stabilized my blood sugars like crazy. I mean, I barely had to use any insulin anymore. I basically have a basal rate that my body kind of gives itself, or the pump gives itself throughout the day. And I don't give myself any more because I'm not really eating many carbohydrates at all. So that was the first thing. The second thing, which was surprising to me, was that plant foods have their own defense mechanisms. And so these have become popular, known as like lectins or phytic acids or oxalates. These are things that foods have in them naturally that disrupt our physiology. They're trying to defend themselves against us. And when I started eliminating foods that had a high amount of these anti-nutrients, as they're called, my blood sugars stabilized even more. This was when I really was able to just set a basal rate and then kind of forget it. Didn't have to bolus for every meal, give myself more insulin because my blood sugars were just stable. And for a type 1 diabetic, that's phenomenal because I'm sitting here trying to think like a pancreas, you know, and give myself the right amounts of insulin. And now I don't have to worry about it really. As long as I stick to the diet that I think humans really evolved to eat, then I'm doing fine.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
And yes, we all know our environment is full of toxins, but you do bring up in the book these anti-nutrients. And I think people know far less about that. As you mentioned, lichens, which are found in grain and some vegetables, but you also list phytic acid, which is found in legumes, oxalates found in some greens, tannins found in many teas. This is interesting. I mean, it makes sense that some plants do evolve to have these kind of natural defense mechanisms and they aren't great to consume. But I think we're surprised by some of that because it's always about eat more greens and tea is very healthy.
Yeah.
Is there certain popular tea out there that you would avoid, or some of the main greens people are probably eating? Where do you think people are probably eating the most anti-nutrients without knowing it?
I think that grains and legumes are probably the two highest that people are eating a lot of, mainly because they're added to a lot of processed foods. grains, and then things like soy can be very processed and added to a lot of processed foods. So if you're avoiding processed foods, you're avoiding some foods high in lectins or anti-nutrients. But we also got to talk about the processing of some of these foods. So in the past, humans have made some of these foods more tolerable because of the way they process them. So if we're talking about grains, using like a sourdough where it's fermented actually reduces the amount of anti-nutrients. Doesn't mean they're not gone. They're still there, but there's way fewer of them. Or soaking beans before you eat them. This has made them more tolerable. I mean, beans are notorious for making us gassy because they have these indigestible proteins, these anti-nutrients. But if we soak them and we get rid of the soaking water, that can decrease the nutrients. Things like if you get like oxalates in some of the greens, like spinach has pretty high oxalates, kale has pretty high oxalates. But if you cook them, it decreases that exposure to them. I guess the amount of the oxalate would affect you. And then things like lectins in nightshade vegetables. So if we look at, which is very interesting here, the Italians eat a lot of tomatoes, and that's a nightshade vegetable that's pretty high in lectins. But if you look at the way that they make their pasta sauce, they blanch the tomato, take the skin off, and then they take the seeds out. And the skin and the seeds is where all the lectins are. Hmm. The vast majority of them are. And so then they make their sauce with what's left. So they're getting way less lectins in the way they eat most of their tomatoes. And so it's part of the reason why they seem to do better on this high tomato diet that they have like in Italy. So it's very interesting that plants would do this. I think that there's, if we look at it evolutionarily, it would make sense though. I mean, if we pick a plant, kill a plant, or take its fruit with its seeds and we eat it, and that seed doesn't survive our digestive tract, then that plant wouldn't survive. It wouldn't be able to pass on its genes or grow another plant somewhere else. So it would defend itself. And so most animals who would get the effects that they get from these lectins, these anti-nutrients, wouldn't go and eat that again, because if they're getting weakened by them and then something starts to chase them, their chance of survival is decreased. But we humans live in this easy world that we created for ourselves. And so we eat these things without thinking about it. And we may have a headache, or we may have some inflammatory condition or something like that, but it doesn't affect our ability to survive because of this world we've created for ourselves. And so we don't really think that it could be causing our disease. We've just been taught that, oh, plants are what humans eat. And that may not be the case all the time. So,
Yes, the world is complex, and we have really lost our education, and we really kind of got to get back into understanding the complexity and the nuance, rather than just saying, eat natural things and avoid the drive-thru. I mean, it is more complex than that. But
yeah.
I also really wanted to dive into the heart, because the things you lay out in that book probably blew my mind the most. Let's start with heart disease. It's considered the number one cause of death, so it should probably get some attention. What do you consider the biggest misconceptions about heart disease?
I think there's two. One is that the heart is a pump, and the heart is actually not a pump. It's something different, and we'll go into that. But the other one is that cholesterol and dietary fat and atherosclerosis in arteries causes heart attacks. I mean, atherosclerosis in an artery is not a good thing to have, but it doesn't necessarily cause a heart attack. So let's get into this. First of all, the heart is not a pump. So there's lots of studies that show that looking at the heart as a pressure propulsion pump, meaning something that would take static water from somewhere, suck it in, and then forcefully pump it out somewhere else, which is what we're taught the heart does, just doesn't add up. Like the physics of our cardiovascular system, if the heart was that type of pump, doesn't make sense. There's many experiments that have been done that show that the heart pumping that way or being the main force of blood flow, the physics of the system doesn't work. And actually, like, the system would collapse because the pressure in the system would collapse. Then we have to ask ourselves, well, how is the blood flowing though if the heart's not pumping it? So I think an important question to ask with that is, how does water get from the ground to the top of a 300-foot tall redwood tree? There's no pump there.
Right.
But it happens. And then people will say, oh, well, you can like siphon barometric pressure, but the maximum you can do that is like 32 feet. And so there's these 300-foot tall trees that have water in their leaves. So how does that happen? Well, this goes to looking at some of the work done by Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington. and before him, Gilbert Ling, they found that water has some unique properties. And so when water has sufficient charge, which water can hold charge, it can harvest energy from the environment and hold energy. When it has enough energy and it's next to a hydrophilic surface, a water-loving surface, then it will create this layer of exclusion zone water or fourth phase water. And when that forms, so let's say we're talking about an artery, which is a hydrophilic surface, and the blood is almost 50% water. So if the water in our blood is charged enough, if it's holding the energy enough, it will form this layer around the artery. And that does two things. That layer protects the artery, provided that we don't have toxins and oxidative damage that will destroy that layer. But it also creates an energy gradient that creates flow. And so Dr. Pollack has done these really interesting experiments where they put a hydrophilic tube in water that has enough charge, and the water just starts flowing through the tube in one direction without any pump or any force on it. And he found that when he supplied energy to this system, this water, indefinitely, the flow would continue indefinitely. And so I think that's more like what we're seeing. And I think that if we look at the heart, its main purpose is not to forcefully pump the blood, because, I mean, it's a good analogy here. So if I was to put a pressure propulsion pump in the middle of a river, A, the river wouldn't need it to be there because the river is already flowing, which the blood is already flowing because of this dynamic we talked about with the fourth phase water in the artery. But it also might get in the way of flow. If we put it in the middle of this flow and it's trying to suck this water that's already coming to it and pump it out the other side, it'd probably slow it down. And so that's one of the things the heart is trying to do, is actually slow the blood. Because if it doesn't, let's say we go out and go for a run, we increase the metabolic demand or the need for blood in our tissues, in our muscles, because we're trying to propel ourselves somewhere. Well, if the heart wasn't there, all the blood would flow over to the arterial side trying to supply the tissues. But since the heart is there, when the blood's coming back from the veins, it slows the flow so that we don't lose pressure in the system. Because if it all flowed toward the arterial side, the venous side would collapse and that would not be good. So one of the roles of the heart is to actually slow the blood so that we can maintain that pressure in a situation where we're getting high metabolic demand. The other role is that Dr. Pollack has found that there's different ways to energize water. And one of them is like radiant light or infrared light, which we can get from the sun. Another is contact with the electromagnetic field that is the earth. That will energize the blood. But another is vortexing, which means swirling. So if we look at, everybody's seen like when water's flowing through a river and it goes past a rock on the other side, it kind of swirls. That would be vortexing. Mm-hmm. And if we look at what the heart is doing as blood is flowing through it on its own, then it's actually vortexing it. So when the blood comes back from the veins to the heart, it gets vortexed. When it flows through the valves, it vortexes. When the heart contracts, it actually, like the muscles in the heart are oriented in a spiral condition or way, so that when it contracts, it spins the blood when it pushes it back out. And that's about all it does. Like it's got about 15% efficiency when we think of the heart as pressure propulsion pump, because all it really does is takes the blood from the ventricle and kind of puts it back out into the venous system. And then the arteries take over because of that fourth phase of water. So I think that the heart is a vortex and it's also there to slow the flow of blood so that we don't get collapse of pressure in the system, which is very interesting. It plays a very different role than I was taught in medical school, but it makes way more sense when we look at it that way. So that's the first big concept about the heart that debunks things. The second is that heart disease in general is not caused by cholesterol or high fat. So I mentioned the first aspect of heart disease is the atherosclerosis, the hardening of arteries. And so that can happen when that layer of fourth phase water that's surrounding the inner layer of an artery gets damaged. And that can get damaged because we're exposed to a lot of toxins or because we're burning carbohydrates, which is increasing the amount of free radicals that we're getting in our system, and various other things can actually break down the lining, that protective layer. And when it gets to the lining of the artery, it can actually damage the lining of the artery. And then our body has to do something about it because we can't let an artery rupture. So what it does is it takes cholesterol and some minerals like calcium, things like that, and it kind of uses it as spackle to plug up that area so that it doesn't rupture. So cholesterol is not what's causing atherosclerosis, or too much cholesterol in the blood is not causing atherosclerosis. It can get elevated in the blood because there's inflammation that's leading to the damage of this artery so that we need more cholesterol there to be spackle. So that's the first aspect. So atherosclerosis is caused by free radical damage, toxins and free radicals being produced from eating too many carbohydrates and things like that. The second aspect is that heart attacks are not caused, or I guess the vast majority of heart attacks are not caused by acute blockages. So we think of as like this stenosis of an artery or closing off of an artery that's because of the atherosclerosis that leads to a further and further blockage of an artery around the heart. Or we think of maybe an artery does rupture and we get a clot formation and that clot flows down to an artery. And so there was some very interesting work done by a guy named Baraldi, who's Italian. And he found that the vast majority of heart attacks had no clot. Well, he found that 50% of the heart attacks in the autopsies he did, there was no clot there. And the ones that there was a clot, he found that the clot was a result of the heart attack, not the cause of the heart attack. And then there was about, I think, like 3.5% where they were caused by an acute blockage, but that does not account for, you know, the hundreds of thousands of heart attacks we see every year. And so if we look at this further, we'll find that what happens in a heart attack is actually a response to, it's actually your body going back to a kind of a more ancient response from your nervous system. So our nervous system is designed to perceive our environment and let us know if we're in a safe or threatening environment. And so before bigger reptiles came around, there was this one nervous system pathway that did that. And it was the vagus nerve, but it was called the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus nerve. And so when that got overstimulated, it would shut metabolism down, maybe even slow the heart rate. And this was when it was advantageous for animals to fake a death. And so that was the mechanism at play there. But then as the organisms got more complex, and especially mammals who are much more metabolically demanding, meaning we can't shut down organs like that without major consequences. We can't fake death without, you know, actually causing damage. And so we evolved this second pathway of the vagus nerve called the nucleus ambiguous pathway. And so that is the vagus nerve, the one that everybody talks about stimulating the parasympathetic aspect of the vagus nerve, you know, rest and digest. Everybody talks about stimulating that. And so, unfortunately, in today's society, we're in this constant state of stress. We tend to take non-life-threatening things as life-threatening because we think too much. We're the only species that can think our way into a stress response. We're very dependent on money to get us all the resources we need to live, which can be very stressful to be dependent on this one thing. If you don't have this one thing, then your health and your life is threatened. And so all these things can combine to overstimulate and shut down that newly evolved pathway, which is that nucleus ambiguous parasympathetic pathway. And when that gets shut down too much and we get a surge of adrenaline from a stressful response, then that old pathway takes over, that dorsal motor nucleus. And that's the one that would cause organ systems to shut down. So we see that in a heart cell, how the heart cells communicate, you know, your nervous system activity to like an individual cell in your heart is that it does that through what's called nitric oxide. And if your body doesn't have enough nitric oxide, which we would get from eating a healthy diet and having healthy endothelia, so, you know, the lining of your blood vessel is where that nitric oxide comes from. If we don't have healthy endothelia, we don't have the nitric oxide, so that signal can't get into the heart cell. And so then we'll get this surge in adrenaline or stress response without the ability of that parasympathetic stress response to get into the heart cell. And that can cause problems. That forces the heart cells to burn carbohydrate rather than fat because it thinks it's in a stressful situation and it needs to get away and we can burn carbohydrates faster. And unfortunately, when a heart cell starts to burn carbohydrate, we get a buildup of lactic acid, just like happens in your leg muscles. You know, when you go for a run, you get a buildup of lactic acid and it starts to hurt. But when that happens in the heart cell, it can actually cause swelling or edema, as we call it. And that swelling can actually change the pressure in the whole system of the heart. And so if we have this swelling that's now forcing pressure out of the cells in the heart rather than the blood putting pressure into the cells of the heart, now the blood can't get in. and then we lose blood supply to an area of the heart. We get necrosis because now there's no nutrition to that specific area of the heart where this happened, and we get tissue death, which is what a heart attack is. We get an area of tissue death. If that tissue death is a substantial enough amount, someone can die from a heart attack. But it's all triggered by our stress response system, and it has almost nothing to do with clots. And that's what Beraldi found. He found that anywhere there was a severe stenosis, like a narrowing of an artery in a coronary artery, like in the heart, that the body had created a bypass around it already, like it had created new arteries around it. And so there was all these examples in his book about men who had 90% or 95% stenoses of coronary arteries, but were running marathons. And it's like, there's no way they're running marathons on 10% to one area of their heart. And so it was because of these collateral arteries that were going around it. That combined with the fact that a stressful response like this, an imbalance in our nervous system, can cause these events to happen, explain that the vast majority of heart attacks, and really a small percentage of them, are actually caused by any type of acute blockage. So that was a long rant, but there you go.
No, I love it. That was a hell of a breakdown. And just to revisit that first part, I've had a few other guests bring up Dr. Pollack's fourth phase of water work, and I was really surprised to see that chapter in your heart book. Funny enough, if everything goes according to plan, Gerald Pollack is my next interview too, which is, you know, why I think this is so interesting, because this context helps to understand blood flow in the heart, and that's very surprising to me. You also later in the book describe the heart as a vortexing hydraulic ram, and note that even Rudolf Steiner used to say that the heart functions more like a damming up organ, that it interrupts the flow of blood. And then also this vortexing thing, it seems like a pretty obscure discovery of Victor Schauberger, that vortexing water kind of supercharges it. That ties in with Dr. Pollack's work and ties in with what Rudolf Steiner is saying. I mean, these are three of the bright minds that I appreciate, all tied in together into this one subject that is quite crucial, because heart disease is our number one killer. And I just thought that was really awesome to see it all line up like that. These alternative people kind of saying the same sort of thing, or aspects of all their work tie into the full understanding of the heart. And I just think that's awesome.
Yeah, I think that one of the coolest things that I found is that the reason that vortexing energizes water is because it increases the contact with oxygen. So like when it's happening in a river, like when it flows past a rock, there's oxygen in the air, and there's also oxygen coming from little bubbles, you know, coming out of the earth from the riverbed. And so when it vortexes like that, it's increasing the contact with oxygen. So I think it's no mistake, and I can't really say anything scientific connecting the two, but I think it's no mistake that our vortexing organ, the heart, is placed right next to our oxygen organ, the blood, and that blood from the heart goes to the lungs and then back to the heart. That just makes sense to me. Again, I can't say anything that scientifically connects the two, but it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. That's why that evolved that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just so interesting because I hear these people's work and we always talk about, oh man, we should implement some of this stuff for a better, more natural society. And here it is working right in our own bodies. And I guess I just overlooked that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. When we talk also so much about the cancer industry, how much money there is in chemotherapy treatments and these long drawn out processes that really just try to kill the cancer before it kills the host. And you're lucky if you can survive the process. And we have all these people running marathons and wearing ribbons and donating all this money, when really in the history, there are quite a few things that seem to work okay that just weren't getting FDA approval. Not surprised. But the heart health industry is just as big, and we don't really ever criticize that as much. But how often do you hear people say, oh, I'm going in for a double bypass, quadruple bypass, getting a stent in the heart? And it's kind of the same thing. Then they're told, oh, don't eat a steak after this, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of backwards, right?
Yeah, totally backwards. And there's so many big studies that looked at big populations. There was one that was at a heart disease center in Houston, looked at 100,000 heart surgeries over 10 years, bypass surgeries. And their conclusion, there was no benefit to these surgeries. And to me, it makes sense, because Beraldi found that, I'll explain what Beraldi did. He If you've ever been to like those Body World exhibits or the Animal Inside Out exhibits where they make a plastic cast of the arterial system of an animal or a fish or something like that, or a human, that's what he did pretty much. He took the hearts of people who had heart attacks, who didn't have heart attacks, or people who just died of an accident, anything. And he started studying them. So he would pump this neoprene or this substance that was liquid. And then when it dried, it became solid plastic. And he pumped that into the arteries. And then he took hydrochloric acid and dissolved away the tissue. And he was left with this mold of the arteries of the heart. And like I said, what he found was that anywhere that there was a more than 70% stenosis or narrowing of an artery, like a main artery of the heart, there was at least anywhere from 16 to 30 collateral arteries, the arteries that went around it, bypassed it by itself. So it makes sense that these bypass surgeries aren't working because the bypass is usually already there. The body's already created it itself. And so when I see the research like that, and then I find the work of someone like Beraldi, it makes absolute sense.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And so what do we do with this information? I mean, proper blood flow, it relates to easy water. And you mentioned ketones. Is there a relationship between ketones and easy water? Or I guess what I'm asking is, how can we use this new understanding to then pivot towards healthy hearts?
Yeah. So to me, there's three things that people need to do to get a high-performing heart. So one is we need to reduce our oxidative stress. So I'll explain what that is. So oxidative stress is basically when we have molecules in our body, there are certain molecules that can come around that we can make through the process of making energy, or that we can get exogenously from like toxin exposure. And they're called free radicals. And that just means that they have an unpaired electron and they want to be paired really badly. I tell patients that it's like the Looney Tunes Tasmanian devil. They're running around like that, causing damage to anything they find, trying to find that extra electron. And so they'll do that. They'll take it from anywhere. They'll take it from exclusion zone water. They'll take it from tissue. They'll take it from anywhere. We have systems in place that are designed to mitigate them. Our antioxidant system is designed to donate that electron without causing damage. But if we get too many of these free radicals, that will damage the lining of the endothelia and the exclusion zone water. So that's one thing. We've got to reduce the amount of oxidative stress, reduce the amount of free radicals that we're exposed to. So that's eating a higher fat diet, so we're making less of that exhaust, so to speak, and then also really reducing your exposure to toxins. Now, as far as ketones go, ketones are something that's made when we're burning fat. And so it actually turns out that our brain and our heart and most organs prefer to burn fat for energy. If given the choice, they will. And when you add ketones to that mix, then their efficiency increases like up to 28%. So pretty impressive. Now, when we eat a lot of carbohydrates, we're training our body to burn carbohydrates as fuel. And when we eat more fat, when we get into ketosis, which is like the buzzword in health circles these days, we're teaching our body to burn fat and then ketones as well. And so before I was talking about how we can get this surge of adrenaline or a stress response that can send us down that cascade of events that leads to a heart attack. And one thing that can prevent that from happening or make it less likely to happen is that if we are fat burning, if our hearts are very good at burning fat and used to burning fat, then they are less likely to convert to burning carbohydrate, which will create that lactic acid, which will create that burn like in your heart, angina that people feel, and eventually lead to a heart attack if the stress response is high enough. So being fat burning, eating a high fat diet, eating good fats, not canola oil, not vegetable oils, those are terrible fats, but the good saturated fats from grass-fed animal products and grass-fed butter and egg yolks and things like that. Those are the good fats that are going to teach your body to burn fat. And then the third one is, I've been talking about this stress response situation. And so, you know, I touched on a little bit how within our society today, we're living in this society that really stimulates this stress response because we are taking non-life-threatening situations and having life-threatening responses to them in our physiology. So this is largely the work of Dr. Robert Sapolsky out at Stanford, and he's studied like the normal stress response in animals in the wild. And like, they don't have one. They're not thinking about anything stressful or anything like that while they're grazing on the savannah. But if something came out to chase them and try and kill them, they have a stress response. And they have that response until they get away, if they get away. But once they get away, the stress response shuts down. Whereas we humans, we could have a stressful event, like we could be in a car accident or almost in a car accident, and we could be thinking about it the rest of the day, stressed out about it. And so that really creates an imbalance in our stress, your nervous system's ability to perceive if you're in a stressful environment or not. And so then again, things like being so reliant on this capitalist society where if you don't have money, then your life is threatened. I mean, that's why we have homeless populations, is because our society is so dependent on money, and when you don't have it, you could starve or become homeless. Things like social isolation. I think that technology has allowed us to communicate very, very well across long distances, but it's also socially isolated us. We are evolved to be in contact with other humans and other animals. And the more isolated we get, there was a study done in elder people who had already had a heart attack. And those people who did not have either a close friend, a spouse, or a pet, I think it was like 5 times more likely to have another heart attack than people who did have those things. So we're definitely supposed to be in contact with other living things. We're social beings. And isolation is one of the biggest stimulators of that imbalanced stress response. So the third thing, I think the most important thing that people need to do for healthy hearts is rebalance that stress response. And so these days, if you look up anywhere on Google, like how to stimulate your vagus nerve, you'll find all these different ways to do it. And when I look at all those different techniques that people do, it's us getting back to the state that we evolved in. So back to nature, which also is very calming to your nervous system. It's back in contact with people that your tribe, so to speak. It's meditation, it's yoga, it's things like that that calms your mind. Those types of things are having a physiologic retraining of your nervous system. And that's probably the number one thing people need to do to create healthy hearts and prevent heart attacks.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of stressors, media is a big one too. Like,
very big one.
Tune into the nightly news every night if you don't want to be stressed out.
It's also negative.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Man, this is just also eye-opening, especially the easy water stuff, because you learn, oh, this is why infrared saunas are so good for us. This is why laying out in the sun is important. It mm-hmm. supercharges the water in our cells. But what about the water we drink? Is there a way to make sure we're getting the best water? What do? Do you vortex it? Do you drink spring water that's high in minerals, blend it to make more bubbles? I hear that increases easy. What about water?
Yeah, so me personally, I drink mineral water, like buying at the store, but also I harvest mineral water from a spring close to me. People go to findaspring.com. They can see if there's one close to them. They can get their own spring water because there's lots of vortexing that happens when it comes out of the earth. And so that water is pretty structured, pretty energized, but it's also full of minerals, which are also very important. Because if you're drinking water that's been demineralized, then it can actually end up stealing minerals from your body because water likes to have minerals dissolved in it. So what I'm doing is for drinking water, I'm doing the spring water either from the store or from the spring near my house. But for cooking, I have a filter, like if I'm using tap water, and we're on a well. So I don't know if there's as many toxins as there would be in the water if I was on a municipal water supply, but I still filter it because you just don't know what's in the groundwater these days. Mm-hmm. I filter it, but then I also vortex it. And I never really drink that water straight, though, because it's demineralized. I usually just use it for cooking. And lots of times when I'm cooking, it's adding minerals to it. Or I make bone broth with it, which is going to add a ton of minerals with it, kind of remineralize it. But yeah, that's where I get most of my water. Yeah, it's just those three sources.
It's funny because people might drink reverse osmosis water or extremely filtered water and think that that's as good as it gets. But a lot of people consider that dead water, and there's a lot of positive things in the water that you want to keep in while taking out the bad, and it just gets pretty complex. But one big aha moment I had in your book was the fact that, you know, with a lot of alternative medicine and places like the Gerson Institute where people are getting treated for cancer or they come in with other serious illnesses, the first thing they do is they give you a ton of smoothies or juices. And a major factor in why that works so well, other than the vitamins and nutrients, is that you're getting an easy water replenishment from the cells of the fruits and vegetables, and it just folds right into making a lot of sense. That was just something that I didn't know a week ago.
Yeah, we mentioned like how water gets from the ground to the tops of the trees. Well, it's the same thing in the plants, you know. The fruits and vegetables that we're eating, if they're fresh, then they're going to have structured water in their cells. I mean, that's Dr. Pollack wrote another book called Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. And he talks about the role of this fourth phase water in the cells. It's just absolutely fascinating. So the cells in these plants also have it. Now, I don't know if a plant is shipped from across the United States and it was picked 2 weeks before you eat it, if the energy in that plant is or goes down the longer it's been since it's picked.
Right.
I don't know, but I would not be surprised because they're probably shipped in crates and the plant has lost its life source, which is the earth and the structuring of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's lost a lot of its not only mineral content and nutrient content, but also its energy in the water in the cells.
Yeah.
So the fresher, the better. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned like juicing and yeah, it's no wonder that people start to get better. I mean, eventually long term, they're going to have trouble with blood sugar because they're taking away all the fiber and everything, but we're putting structured water directly into the bodies. We're creating higher levels of physiology just by structuring the water in their bodies. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, it's and that was another eye opener, the no pump in plants. Like there's no heart in a palm tree, but it gets the water where it needs to go all the way to the top.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just because this water kind of does its own thing. And you also have a line in the book where you say something to the effect of, because we know easy water in our blood kind of pumps itself, this could even change our energy and plumbing systems if we did it right. I mean, how much energy do we put into these giant water plants and plumbing systems just to get water through all our pipes, where if we had properly energized or vortexed water, it would kind of push itself through the pipes. And that would be just a huge efficiency win for our society.
Yeah, I mean, opportunities abound there. If we learn to use that technology, or not even really technology, it's more like a discovery of water properly, you know, we could do away with dams, you know, all this hydroelectric energy we're having to create. Like, we don't need it. We don't need the river flow. We could create flow ourselves, you know, or design a system where the water would flow itself. And so we don't have to destroy these ecosystems by putting up dams and things, I think. But we'll see if anybody gets a hold of this technology and funds the research to develop devices like that.
Yeah, it would be awesome to see just one city try to tackle that and then be able to study the data of how the people who lived there were affected. And in terms of the ketogenic diet and getting more quality fats in our diet, I still kind of struggle with this. I know it's not right to equate protein and fat, but I almost just do. I just eat a lot of protein and hope, well, there's some fat in there too. But that's not the right approach. And I got a little list online. Tell me what you think, you know, if there's any changes you would make. But this article says the 10 best foods high in fat would be avocados, cheese, dark chocolate, whole eggs, fatty fish, nuts, chia seeds, and extra virgin olive oil. Is there something missing? How would you adjust that?
The thing missing is the saturated fats from animals, like red meat. I mean, it's got this major negative connotation and there's absolutely no reason for it to. I mean, there's people that are thriving on all red meat diets and they have been for years. Doesn't mean that we all should do that or that we would all thrive like they would, but it's gotten this bad rap and I don't understand why. I mean, all these studies about how high protein will destroy your kidneys or cause heart disease. I mean, we already explained how cholesterol and narrowing of arteries won't cause a heart attack. While atherosclerosis is not a good thing to have, it's not going to directly lead to a heart attack. But I think that that's the biggest thing that's missing from that list is that I think evolutionarily, and you can look at the work of Miki Bindor in Tel Aviv University, I think humans are pretty much designed to eat meats. We've evolved to eat plants as well, and we can do that, and we can survive on plants. And there's some plants that can be argued that they're good for us, but I think that the good fats from either grass-fed or wild animals and from egg yolks and butter and things like that, I think that those are the fats that give us life. I think that, A, they're going to convert you to burning fat and making ketones and ketogenic more quickly. But if we're so designed or evolved to burn that fat, and that fat lots of times comes with protein, there's no way that that protein could be bad for you. I mean, humans have been eating meat for millions and millions of years. And heart disease is in the epidemic that we're seeing it today is only maybe 200 years or so that we've seen this massive rise in heart disease. Now, there's evidence that ancient Egyptians had atherosclerosis. They did like CT scans on the mummies and they found like, I think it was like 30-40% of them had atherosclerosis, but they were a farming culture. They were eating lots of different grains. It's very well known based on the study of their culture that they didn't eat meat that much. It wasn't a huge part of their diet. And so that's the big thing missing there is that people really need to get over this meat or this animal fat or saturated fat causes heart disease or that it's bad for you. It's probably one of the best as long as it's from a wild or grass-fed, very naturally raised animal.
Mm. Well said. I thought that's exactly what you might bring up, the fat from animals and butter as well. Do you have a problem with cheese or dairy?
Well, this one's kind of near and dear to me because if we look at the mechanism of autoimmune disease, a lot of it can be that there's this molecular mimicry. So basically, I can get leaky gut, which means that things in my intestines are leaking into the bloodstream before they're supposed to because there's holes in my gut. And there are certain molecules in foods that have been linked with certain autoimmune diseases. One of them is gluten for thyroid disease or hypothyroid, like Hashimoto's hypothyroidism. And so if some of those gluten molecules leak into the bloodstream when they're not supposed to, and then your body has an autoimmune reaction to them because they're not supposed to be there, well, some of those look just similar enough to cells in the thyroid that your body also attacks the thyroid. And so for me, it hits close to home because casein protein found in dairy looks very similar to beta cells in the pancreas that make insulin. And so I think that at some point in my life, I probably had pretty severe leaky gut, and I definitely had all kinds of dairy, pasteurized dairy at that, which was already damaged protein when I was a kid. And I think that it's very likely that some of those proteins leaked into my bloodstream. My body attacked that casein protein and then also attacked the beta cells in my pancreas. So that's not to say that no one should have dairy. Obviously, a certain percentage of the population has evolved to eat dairy because we have that lactase persistence, but then other people are lactose intolerant because they don't have that lactase persistence, and so they can't do that. But I think that, I mean, humans are still evolving, and I think that some of us have evolved to handle dairy just fine. If we get raw grass-fed dairy, that can be a very nutrient-dense food source for us and a good source of fat, but others of us may do better staying away from it. I just think that depends on how long your ancestors have been using milk as a food source, because there were certain areas of the world where it became necessary and there were other areas of the world where it wasn't. And so it's really hard to trace your genetic line these days and figure that out. But maybe one day we'll have some sort of testing that could tell us that. I think we're getting pretty close. But if I was going to do an elimination diet and figure out what foods are triggering people, I would not include dairy and then have them add it back and see if they did well with it.
Mm. Yes. Well, I hope my ancestors have been doing it for a while because I have quite a dairy addiction. More so, I could give up sugar a lot easier than I could give up dairy, I think.
Yeah.
And so with the ketogenic diet, I hear about it on a lot of podcasts, and it almost seems like you already have diabetes with all the blood monitoring and the daily attention to detail and the biohacking that is involved with the people who are really into the ketogenic diet. I just don't know that that kind of monitoring and stuff is something I could keep up with. And it doesn't have to be that way. As long as you're eating the right things, you could probably forego all the insane monitoring. But how do you feel about ketone supplements or pills or taking them in that form?
I'm always cautious about any supplement. I think that they can be useful, exogenous ketones. If I had someone come to me and was at terrible risk for having a heart attack and really wanted to immediately increase the function of their heart, exogenous ketones can help your body get into that fat burning mode quicker. But that's not something I want somebody to rely on for a long time. I want to teach their body through diet to make those ketones themselves. But that's the only time I would ever use them. And oftentimes I think that the supplements that we have are, people use them as not excuses, but they don't eat as well as they should, or they stray from keto, and then they use these things to get back into keto. It's like this little hack they can do. And I'm not a fan of that because, I mean, if you've read Health Evolution, you know, I think that if we're all making the best decisions possible for our health, it's actually better for the planet. I want people to rely on things like that that will keep them living this destructive lifestyle and then be able to hack their way back to their health. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. It does. And people really should look for local food sources. I try to, on the show, give people as many options as we can, but it's a national audience, a worldwide audience. And that's kind of what we're trying to get away from, is some kind of supply that makes it nationwide, because it's just not the right way. But I'm sure there are local meat producing farms in your area. I'm sure there's plenty of subscription based fruit and vegetable baskets you can get from local farms in your area. And it just takes a couple of Google searches, and you could really make a huge impact in doing that and save yourself precious time, because they send it right to your house.
That's right. I mean, farmers markets, obviously, there's farmers markets everywhere, and obviously you're having to deal with things in season, but that's the way we should be eating anyways.
Yeah.
But also there's a good website, eatwild.com, where you can go and look for all like the places where you can get grass-fed and pastured animal products close to you, farms near you that you can go to and get them from.
Cool. Eatwild.com. That's one I did not know about. So awesome.
Yeah.
And of course, you have these two books. Both of them are really great. I enjoyed reading through them both. Is there anything else people should know about your website or anything before I cut you loose? I mean, you have this coaching going on, and it is quite reasonable price-wise.
Yeah. So, I mean, at resourceforhealth.com is where I'm doing my health coaching, but I'm also working on, I mean, I have a blog there that I'm working on trying to put out interesting things. And then I'm working on developing courses. So one about the heart, one about evolution and like mastering evolution to achieve health. And then probably one about autoimmunity as well. I'm working on those because I'm trying to get as many different avenues for people to hear the message and improve their health. You know, whether they like to read a book or listen to podcasts or do the health coaching or do online courses. Like, I'm trying to get as many different ways out there as possible. So I'll have those up on the website, hopefully, if I can figure out how to do it soon. But that's what I'm working on now. And then, yeah, I'm trying to make the website a place where there's as many different resources as possible. So I'll be doing little ebooks and things like that. People can find all kinds of information there.
Awesome, man. Yeah, build that business. It's a noble thing. It's a great way to make a living. We all have to make a living. You can either be a cog in the big machine or find some way to, you know, live the path you want to live, bring out your true self and your expertise and kind of fight back against it while still being able to pay the bills. I mean, we're not going to change the whole system. We can only change our position in it and how we react to it. So I think that's great.
Yeah, and show people a way to do it as well. That's the one goal for me. Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. It's been a blast.
You got it. Best of luck out there.
You too.
Sweet Mother Mary of the Mushroom People, Dr. Stephen Hussey, bringing all sorts of fun stuff to the table. And I hope you had a good time. I know when Dr. Hussey contacted me and sent over his books, and I saw the fourth phase of water was a chapter in his heart book, I knew it was going to be worth getting into. I mean, this ties right back to the Water Alchemy episode with Shaman Janier. And understanding this about the body is really interesting to me. That this negatively charged, structured water is what actually is in our cells, and that it's this negative charge that helps the blood move through our veins, is pretty mind-blowing to me. It's energy, it's motion, with very few ingredients, because it makes so much sense. It speaks to magnetism and charge, and these sorts of ether physics principles being right there in plain sight. It explains why sunlight helps with blood flow and why saunas and infrared light are so good for us. It's like the things Victor Schauberger was on being right in the body, in some of our most fundamental systems. Because honestly, it is pretty illogical to think that the heart is responsible for pumping blood through thousands of different channels and then back again. And with heart disease being such a killer, this understanding goes a long way in flipping the script on heart health. And it's this type of thinking, this simple, natural, holistic type of perspective that leads to flying saucers. I'm serious. I absolutely think it's why we are not taught about blood this way, or why they don't teach easy water in school. Because anti-gravity properties are probably not that complex. The flying saucer pie is really just made up of natural magnetism, something-something rotation, and using the environment, and for example, the fact that the Earth has a net negative charge, to engineer a repelling force to that. And there is more than one way to get there, too. Check out some of these alternative science conferences. You know, everyone asks me why I don't go to conspiracy conferences anymore. And I just say, well, you can go to ether conferences or secret science Tesla conferences and see people working on the very stuff that conspiracy conferences are still debating the existence of. Man, I didn't expect to go so far into this tangent so quickly, but I just think it's another example of the scientific paradigm being twisted and warped and complexified, and all these obstacles worked around to come up with an explanation that doesn't reveal the simple universal truths in our environment and how they work. So I really liked this show, and we focused on the heart quite a bit because of this stuff. And we didn't get too deep into his health evolution book until the second half, which, as I said, people here will have mixed feelings about using a term like evolution, but I look for ways to agree with people rather than looking for points of difference to focus on and hammer home. So if we just think of his advice as in line with the natural systems of the environment, that's what I'm after. He calls it evolution. But what he's looking at is how humans synced up with their environment for hundreds of thousands of years before we tried to take shortcuts and beat the thing into submission. I mean, that's really what agriculture was. It was gaming the system. And it definitely had consequences. But I like the idea of looking back to the past and working with our knowledge of our ecosystem to engineer abundance and all that good stuff. The idea of going back to nature, but bringing our modern technology with it. It's what I thought was attractive about the Venus Project initially. Sure, the proposed vision of Jacques Fresco is all controlled by a central AI, but if you can get past that, the models looked quite nice. So I really like where Dr. Hussey's focus is. We didn't get to touch on this, but in his book, he even talks about little tricks of language that have screwed us up so bad, like our multiple meanings for the word fat. We think eating fat equals getting fat, but in most other languages, they have completely different words for dietary fat and becoming fat, so they don't get tripped up on that one equals the other element. Also, if someone is unclean, we call them dirty. But the dirt is what makes us healthy in a lot of ways. So just the words we use sometimes screw up our understanding of things that are actually good for us. We have this subconscious aversion because of our language. By accident or design, I don't know, but it ain't good. Anyway, it's nice to be getting a show out for May. I know we're a little late to the May party. Both me and my special lady had family come in town. And I've also had some back-end work that needed attention, but we're here now, and I am psyched about what's coming. In fact, I can now safely say that Dr. Pollock is our next guest. All right, we did it. It's happening. And while we did retread a little bit of ground from today, once we get past the introductory stuff and I got into some questions that Shimon Janier gave me, Dr. Pollock shares some things and goes some places I did not expect him to go, and it's really exciting. But that's mostly in the plus show, because that's just the way conversations work. But he did mention that maybe he said too much, which is always music to my ears, so get ready. Had I actually recorded a show with Dr. Pollock before this one, You know, I might have switched up where our focus was, but sometimes with these really big names that I don't think I'm ever going to be able to talk to directly, we have to talk to other people about their work. Call it the THC insurance policy, but regardless, we do a little double dip in this month. But I hope people think this information is so interesting that that's fine. But next week's Plus Show is really something to behold. And I probably shouldn't even say that. You know, I shouldn't overhype the thing because that always ruins everything, right? No one likes going into a movie that all your buddies have said, oh, this is a 10 out of 10 for sure. You watch it and you're like, it's good. It's all right. But it doesn't live up to the expectations because you saw it last. And other people like me built it up. But I'm happy about it. You're going to like it, I think. But today's Plus Show is great, too. We talked about how our pets keep us healthy, wild versus domestic fruits and vegetables. I mean, you hear that all the time with animals, but this actually comes into play with plant life as well. Of course, you got to give a little dedication to the modern EMF soup that we're living in and what it's doing to our bodies. If you're going to do a health show, it's got to be there. We talked about what Dr. Hussey calls the selfish solution, new and exotic healing technologies, and the good doctor's health coaching success stories. So treat yourself. Of course, a podcast like ours is going to have way more free listeners than paid. It's like 1 in 20 actually get the full show. But man, it would drive me crazy if I thought the first hour was good enough and valuable enough to keep tuning into it. And then not get that second hour. I mean, look, I'm not trying to drive anyone crazy, but I think I put more time into preparation and more time dedicated to editing than so many other podcasts, and I just think it's worth $8. Sign up at thehiresidechatsplus.com, even for just a month or two, and see for yourself that the full episodes are definitely worth your time. You can always cancel. And I'd rather you shoot me one or two $8 tips, download a bunch of your favorite shows, and then cancel, than never hear them at all. But that said, the joint session this month is on the 20th. It's a Monday. It's Victoria Day in Canada. And we're going to be drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and turning the THC stage over to the fine people who listen. The last one was about 3 hours, maybe even more. And we got to some great stuff, and I know a lot more people wanted to talk, but it's just the nature of the beast. A lot of people answered my call that our previous one was pretty light, and I also got the YouTube thing going. So we had a lot of people. And in that situation, we're just never going to get to everyone. I'm sorry about that. I've gotten some emails from people who have taken that quite personally, but don't. I don't know any of you, so how could I really single you out to be ignored? You know, it's like if you attend The Price is Right, but you don't get picked, it's not because Drew Carey has some kind of problem with you. But to those folks, hopefully I'll get to you next time. I appreciate everyone who listens. I have the best job in the world. And I try to take it quite seriously and produce a good show for you. So I hope you think that that is still happening. Good, useful show today. Big Dr. Pollock interview coming up next. And many other good things on the calendar. So I'll see you then. Big thanks to Dr. Hussey. Check him out for his consultations and coaching if you need a little extra push. And big congrats to Denver for decriminalizing magic mushrooms. I've done my part. Your move, heart health hiders, corporate glyphosate-soaked monocrop perpetuators, and deceivers of our sickness system. Your fucking move. I won't take it. No, I refuse. If it's all right, I'll keep my refuge. I've been scheming of bigger things and have to leave my old life behind. Got a transfer to the inner earth. I built a box, built a home. Now you'll find me in the bunker. Bunker.
Plans are simple. The best protection of all is the special shelter built according to specifications of your local civil defense organization. The basement of any house or building will become a good improvised shelter if you block the windows with sandbags. If you don't have sandbags, just what can you do?
Bunker, take it under. You'll find me in the bunker. Bunker, bunker, take it under. Find me in the bunker, bunker, take it under. Find me in the bunker.